Hello, I'm Erica McIntyre, Jason's Connections Content Director. Today our founder, Jason Harris, will be speaking with Dennis DeBott of Autism Risk and Safety Management, an organization whose mission is to provide autism training and resources for law enforcement, emergency first responders, parents, educators, care providers, parents. Oh, I put that in there twice. Shoot, okay, I'm going to start over one more time. I put that in there twice, I didn't mean to.
Yeah, oh.
I put parents and educators in there twice. I copied and pasted wrong. Okay, third time is the charm. Hello, I'm Erica McIntyre, Jason's Connections Content Director. Today our founder, Jason Harris, will be speaking with Dennis DeBott of Autism Risk and Safety Management, an organization whose mission is to provide autism training and resources for law enforcement, emergency first responders, parents, educators, care providers, and the autism community. Dennis is the proud father of Brad, a young man who has autism. A professional investigator and law enforcement trainer, Dennis has authored or co-authored over 35 articles and books. As a presenter, trainer, and public speaker, Dennis is well known for his ability to connect with diverse audiences. For over 20 years, Dennis has presented his multimedia trainings for agencies including the Department of Homeland Security's Federal Law Enforcement Training Center.
Thank you for joining us today. Can you tell us about your experience in law enforcement?
Sure. I'm happy to, Jason. I had a 37-year career as a licensed investigative agency owner, and that work took me around the country, throughout North America, and to different countries over that career. But after, I started that in 77 and have retired from that industry in 2014.
Mm-hmm. And what is autism risk and safety management?
It's a website with information that parents, educators, law enforcement professionals, anyone interested in this subject matter can access. There's free material to download. And it's a place where myself and other colleagues that I have now in this area of autism training for police and public safety. It's a place for us to gather, share information, and help educate each other to our needs.
Mm-hmm. And how did you get involved in autism advocacy?
When we learned our son, Brad, was diagnosed with autism or prior to it, this was around 1986, 87, so it was before Rain Man came out. So we were introduced to the autism community through our son. And when he was a little boy, as a dad, oftentimes I would take him to ball games or go to downtown Detroit. I'm a native Detroiter. We would go to festivals and ride the people mover. Some days we'd go swimming when the weather was warmer. And oftentimes we'd go to the local mall. And I'll never forget one contact I had which set me down this road was when I was with my son. He was maybe 4 or 5. I could still pick him up, carry him. And we were in a toy store in a mall, and he became upset. Couldn't tell you why. It could have been the noise. It could have been the lighting in there. It could have been the fact he wasn't going to get a $300 drivable battery-operated car. I don't know. But he became upset, screaming, crying. He was red-faced, teary-eyed, and everybody was looking at us, store staff, other shoppers. And I knew that I needed to get him out of there, get him to a place with lesser sensory, a lower sensory climate. And by the time I got him back to our car and was putting him into his child seat, I looked up and I was now surrounded by mall police and the local police from the community up there near Detroit. So there's 4 or 5 police cars. I can't leave. And now officers were attempting to quiz my son about who I was. And when I said, hey, what's going on here? That's my son. I showed my ID. That's when they said, we're responding to multiple reports of a possible child abduction from the mall. And that was a contact I was not prepared for. I was able to, after many minutes, convince law enforcement on scene that I indeed was his kid's father, that he had autism. And they were slow to let us go, but they did. And I thought, wow, what's life going to be like for my son when he's not 4 or 5, but 24 and 25, and hopefully has the independence that in the community that everybody wants for themselves. And if I wasn't there to help interpret or explain things, well, how would this go in the future? And that scared me. And it caused me as an investigator, and as a writer, by that time I had written for my hometown Detroit News and for other publications, and worked in documentary production for on investigative pieces for British and Canadian and U.S. companies. So I used that background to do research into the interactions between children and adults with autism, and quickly found out that there was no information in the late 80s, early 90s. No one had reported on it. There was nothing to gather because it didn't exist. So it set me off on a mission to take a look, an investigative look at these contacts, find out if there are any predictable events, and then research some and report on information that can help make these contacts less frequent, safer, and less risky. So that mission started in 1991, and so now we're 25 years into it.
Wow. So how do you share information to such a diverse audience, about such a diverse group of people?
Yeah, by defining this group of people. And what I've learned, an effective way of defining it, is taking a look at how independent the child, adolescent, or adult who may have some form of autism is. And so if we're looking at the independence on a spectrum, well, we're going to have certainly all children up to a certain age are fully dependent on an adult, typically their parents or family members, for their safety and security, not to mention their food, clothing, and shelter. By the time a child reaches the age of 7 or 8, a typical child, they are now getting skills to recognize a risk for them and then take steps to manage it. But there will be individuals on the autism spectrum who may not get to that point throughout their lifetime. So those folks who are less independent typically have their communications are non-existent, or if they do exist, won't be understood by people that don't know them. They may not have the ability to safely cross a street, or avoid the deep end of a body of water if they do not know how to swim. So that person on the spectrum, some will need an appropriate assistant, if you will, or care provider with them, really, at all hours of every day. Then on the other end of the spectrum, and I'm not talking about the middle yet, but on the other end, you'll have people who will get that independence, will be able to express their needs clearly. Who will be able to cross the street safely. They won't jump in the pool if they can't swim. They will learn how to drive or use public transportation, perhaps attend university, heck, teach there. They may get married. And from that more independent end of the spectrum, more likely to have an employment opportunity. And then in the middle, you'll have some people whose independent skills vary, but still may need someone to help them through a contact with law enforcement, or if it's a matter of public safety, they would need somebody with them at all times. So that's in a very brief way how you would explain this really diverse population to an audience that doesn't need, and they're not going to be able to understand every nuance of autism, but to get a general idea of the type of contact they'll have and the individuals that they'll predictably come into contact with, where they're at on the spectrum.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that's really a good way to explain it. Does your work only apply to those with autism, or can it relate to other disabilities and mental health issues as well?
Yes, and I have in the past. I can only see it through the looking glass or the prism of autism, because that's what my son has lived with, you know, every moment of his life, and that we lived with too. But yes, it does translate into other developmental disabilities, any developmental disability, people with intellectual disability, for example, cerebral palsy, another example, or Tourette syndrome, as well as people who have any form or any mental health condition in life, whether it's personality disorder or depression, and it extends even further. People with cognitive disabilities, and it could include Alzheimer's, dementia, traumatic brain injury, conditions such as fetal alcohol syndrome. It would even extend to people who come from different cultures, whose grasp in America, English, would be either poor or non-existent, and who would also have difficulty with conforming to, or at the basic, understanding our social expectations and some of the social requirements that we have here in this part of the world. It may be different elsewhere. But if you're limited in that area, this training would also be useful for that population.
Mm-hmm. What is some of the main advice you give to law enforcement or parents or care providers of some sort?
That information will shape the contact. And so beyond that, for parents, for people on the spectrum, for educators, the broad philosophy would be embrace disclosure. Because without disclosure, a law enforcer will not know that it's time to do things differently. So, mm-hmm. So, just to clear that up, I can't expect anybody, even the best autism specialist, to be able to walk into a room or into an area where there may be 200 or 300 people, or even 20 or 30, and just observe them not up close, and then accurately pick out who has autism or not in that group. Just some people, you'll have better luck than others. It may be more obvious. They may have body language or other sights or sounds you may hear or not that could, give you a hint that, oh, maybe they have autism. But there will be so many people who will not display that you'll be wrong more than right. So in this work, you want to really make it easy for law enforcement to say, okay, this is probably autism. And when that happens, then the message for police, public safety, and others is, time is your asset here. When it's safe to do so, expect this call to take longer for a variety of reasons, to establish communication, to manage the sensory environment, to give people enough time to self-regulate their own anxiety that we'll all have when police come around. You get anxious.
Mm-hmm.
So the message for the autism community is, think about disclosure to make it easy for the law enforcer who's had the training to know that this is a call where things will be different.
Yeah, because I know one of the things is one of the issues with disclosure is the not feeling that you'll be understood, or that you'll be misunderstood, or there'll be assumptions of who you are once you disclose. So it sounds like there's reassurance on that side as well.
Well, the research is anecdotal; it's practical, but there's over the years in the training room and everything that I've written, the feedback's been good. People are embracing the concept. So what do we have now in 2016? We have autism groups that have created personal disclosure cards. So if you chose to, they you could provide information. They would provide you with a card that you could carry on your person that you could use when it when it's safe to do so during a contact with law enforcement. That's one scheme. So it's carrying information in print that would help explain to an on-scene officer. There are other parts, communities in North America that are taking that concept and offering the same service through their emergency call center, 911, or in other parts of the world, 112 or 999, whatever that may be. And it's of course voluntary, but if as an adult someone chose to do it, or parents for younger children, or for the person that really needs help, especially if they were to get away from a care provider and now couldn't navigate the community, there would be information in that computer database that could be linked to cell phone, to home phone, to even a license plate on a car. It could be, in some cases, decals are created. And again, they're voluntary. But in 2016, law enforcement, public safety, at least in North America, but in other places in the world, they are able to access that information from handheld computing devices or communication devices, pads, iPhones, computers in patrol vehicles, where 15, 20 years ago, that would have been a dream. So it expands the disclosure opportunities of these programs. So
when it sounds like groups are the parents and the law enforcement and the self-advocates are working together to make a solution, which helps too.
Yes, I mean, that certainly wasn't when I first started out, nobody was even thinking about it. But, you know, all these years later, yes, more and more people are working together. Sure, there are, and again, when I say disclosure is voluntary, yeah, it always is. If you're at a level that you can speak for yourself clearly and the anxiety isn't going to override your ability to do that, then you should be able to tell people. But carrying some additional information, so that if they're not, if they don't believe you, for example, if somebody were that able and the police said, well, you know, we're going to have to talk to you, or can you prove that you have autism? Well, there'd be nothing wrong with that.
So if somebody asked somebody, I mean, if they prove they have autism, I have autism and I don't necessarily carry my medical records around. Like, how would somebody prove they have autism?
Well, one simple way would be to keep the name and phone number of the diagnostician. So you don't need all your records, but you know, all right, here's how you prove it. This is the person that, performed the diagnosis. They did the research. This is my doctor or a psychologist or whoever was the diagnostician. That would be, rather than carrying around, you know, 100 pieces of paper. And that won't come up very often, to be honest with you. Okay. That may come up. That may come up if you're a victim or a witness or someone's accusing or investigating you as a potential offender or alleged offender. Then you probably would need to prove your diagnosis, but that would most likely be done through a lawyer.
So, I mean, it seems like some of this, there's been a lot of some of this, even outside of just the autism community, with incidents with officers. Why do you think some of that stuff happens in certain situations?
Well, if you can, just, you know, give me an example. Are you talking about people getting killed or injured or falsely accused? Or?
Yeah, I think some of those instances would be, you know, either brush-ins that are causing death or even accusations that don't tend to be true. Why do you think some of that stuff happens some of the time to even groups outside of just people on the spectrum?
Yeah, well, you know, these lives we live are short, but they're complicated. And sometimes when we either don't know the rules, we may be more likely to break them if we don't know the rules, or two, we know the rules, but, you know, there's something else that causes us to break the rules, whether we intended to or not. So each one of those contacts will have its own set of facts and circumstances. About why the police were called, what happened, did they know the person had disability or not. So it's hard to give you a, well, this is why it happens. There's a lot of reasons it happens, but I gave you a few. But each one of these contacts that are high risk, will the officer's safety is a primary part of their duty. So in the training room, trainers such as myself, and I had to learn this, of course, is that everything that you talk about, there has to be a reason for it, and the primary reason is officer safety followed by citizen safety. That's the primary reasons. Another primary reason is to help them make best use of their time and resources. So if they know it's an autism-related call, and they spend more time in the field and have a good quality resolution where nobody gets hurt, and people take the time to get things right, then that's the best use of time and resources, because the third is to avoid litigation. That's the worst use of time and resources, when somebody gets hurt, permanently injured, they die, they're falsely accused. Lawsuits can follow, and as police management, their concern is to limit that, lower that risk. So this training accomplishes those primary goals.
You think it? You think there's ways that the community can engage with police in more effective ways as well?
To communicate. I'm sorry, I missed the question. This phone isn't the best. I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Do you think there's ways that us as a community can learn to engage with police in a more effective way as well?
Yes, I do, and I think, and I know, because I've seen these partnerships happen. As much, and I can make a terrific case, and have been for a long time, that law enforcement needs to understand people with autism, get some general information, and then try to get personal. The more information they know about a particular person, the better they can interact with them. But even if they just know they have autism, there's good information that they can use, and it's generic. It may or may not work, but we can give them that advice. So here's a community that has, 20 years ago, had no training about this. Now, very large section of our society in America, in the world, they had no training. So over the 20 years, that training skills gap is starting to be filled. So they get, by and large, there's a growing number of policing agencies, large and small, who see the value of this. So they're learning about how to interact with a segment of our society that, according to research, we'll have a higher rate of contact with them. So they get that. I think what we're not getting as well is that the autism community, people who are on the spectrum, their families, people that they work with and care for, can do a better job of learning what the unique needs and requirements of law enforcement may be, and getting to know them, and asking them to, you know, work with our community. So if we can educate children and teens and adults with autism and make them part of the training, they will learn, and this isn't a one-off. This has to be done at least once a month until the person acquires a skill. So each side can learn from each other in a safe setting. What the nuances are when they would have to use that skill in an emergency. So the value of training for police is they know they're going to get anxious. They know they're going to lose their skills under stressful conditions. They already know that. So what is the antidote? is to train for it, to make their skills become more rote-like, where they can, they know they're going to be anxious, but they still have the skill, they can get through the contact. And I would say for our autism community folks, learn a little bit about what a contact will be. If your child goes missing, and now you're you've called 911 and they're there, or they're aggressive, and the police are now there, or in like in my case, no one had done anything wrong, but people thought that I was possibly abducting my child. Now we're in contact. You will, and it's okay to feel that. Hey, they're treating me like I've done something wrong. Well, they don't know that you didn't. Mm-hmm. So they have to go through that procedure. So you don't take it personally would be a piece of advice I would want to leave. It's okay that you feel that way, and it probably is true that they are quizzing you because they're not sure if you did have a hand in this or not. But the antidote for that is having information already prepared. So having a plan in place and then executing it in your local community would be what I would say would improve these contacts. And that's the role families, educators, people on the spectrum can play. Get your plan together. Reach out to your police, your fire rescue, your emergency medical, the juvenile courts, all those folks. And extend your hand and say, we want to help you understand us, and we want you to help us understand you. So when we have contacts, they're going to be safer and hopefully less frequent through that process. So it's really educating both communities. They're going to have the contacts. They might as well be informed.
I think that's a really great point. Is there anything you wish the general public knew about autism or about being a police?
Yeah, well, the general public, society, you know, the repressive regimes, North Korea has a police department. They're on call 24/7. So every it's a basic function of society globally, even in repressive governments. So yeah, get to learn that the people that we depend on in those vehicles for our security, you know, they're people too. They, you know, they have families. If this number is accurate in America, 1 out of 68 families affected, well, that includes police officers' families or ER nurse or the probation officer or, you know, the judge. And so seek these people out if you're in the autism community and help them teach their colleagues about what's going on. And that would be true for really any citizen, whether you're connected to the autism community or not, they're just folks too, like us, who want to have fun, work hard and make friends. It doesn't get any more complicated than that, but judging a group of people on an incident that may have had terrible consequences, and it doesn't help out in social media or elsewhere to just jump on a train where all the information isn't in yet, and make judgments where what seems simple usually doesn't turn out that way.
Mm-hmm. So to bring it all together, I mean, what do you do outside of this, and what's your relationship like with Brad, and what's he up to?
Well, he's employed. He works at Martin Memorial Health Center here. He keeps those ER rooms and other critical areas in the hospital clean. He was a drummer in his teens, but he switched over to guitar, and he's getting pretty darn good at it. We play together sometimes. That's a fun thing I've been doing since I was a kid. And he lives with us, but he certainly has the skills to live independently. I think what's limiting him and other younger people is the money these days. Mm. But that'll change. He enjoys the community. He's learned how to drive, so he has that kind of independence, so that's a good thing.
Great. Is there anything else?
Yeah, there is. I would just say to people who are listening in here who nowadays in mid-2016, most of us have heard of autism and the people that have it, but just think about the opportunities someone with autism can give you to learn about something interesting. Make a friend. These are, by and large, this is a community of people that want, like I said, the same things we all do. Work, have fun, make friends. Maybe more difficult for them, but let's make it less difficult because these are terrific workers. They're fun people, honest. This is a very honest population. So my advice would be to folks who maybe have a little knowledge of autism is, you know, get to know somebody who has it and, you know, make a new friend.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point. I think you're right. A lot of people know what autism, at least have heard of the definition of autism. I think people don't always know the diverse amount of people who in the population itself. But I think that's one of the great things of being able to get to know people.
Right, yeah, because, hey, we're all part of the human condition here. And as humans, we all just need to get along a little better. Please cut me a break, and I will please cut you a break. And when we all can do that, we'll have better outcomes here just simply by doing that.
I think that's a really good point. I think from every angle, even just talking about, even thinking about how to even cut police officers a break, because that's a group of a population.
Right, and it's when we learned Brad had autism, Jason, we made a pretty quick decision that we need to let him know, and that, you know, we all have our conditions in life. This is one of yours. People are going to find you interesting. They're going to be curious about the fact you have autism, but you can't ever use it as an excuse for anything.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's lived a life where we've talked about it openly from the moment we knew, and still do. So he's become a very good self-advocate and very well-spoken when he goes on camera. He's been interviewed by the news down here. He's attended many of my sessions. He provides direct advice, as many other people with autism do. So his voice is being heard. He's in a couple of our training videos. So, you know, he gets this, and we're much more comfortable now than we ever could have been back when this was such an eye-opening subject matter. It's getting less so, but we've got a lot more work to do. We'll get it done, and we'll get it done through Jason's connection. I know that.
I mean, we love what you're doing. We actually have a friend who's named Rick Wadati. He does different photographs of people with disabilities to sort of show the personality. I think one of the things, though, is he wanted us to see if you wanted to we could give you his contact information. I think he wants to do something like sort of be able to film a video sort of with you about sort of some of the things that you talk about to be able to show to medical professionals and other professionals as well.
Yeah, where's Rick located?
I think he's in New York, but he travels a lot.
Oh, okay. Because I'm going to be in New York City Thursday night. I'm speaking there, and then Friday for families and people with autism in the evening. And then the next day I'll be at the New York Police Academy to present to 300 or 400 police officers and supervisory officers. And this is my 9th year of working directly with NYPD. So is it near the city?
I think he's near the city. I would have to see if he's even in the city now because he travels all over the world to take photographs. But we can set something up because I think he wants to do something through one of us.
Oh, that would be great. Yeah, please do.
Yeah, and I'm glad that I've heard from you from Leanne. It seems like you've done amazing things. Even what I've read, it seems really cool what you've done.
Well, with a lot of help, more has to be done. So I know with you, Jason, and Erica, and all the great folks that support what you're doing, that we can get this done. It doesn't cost a lot of money, but developing a safety plan is something that everybody should look at. I don't care if you have autism or not. Just so you get an idea of what your risks are, and the more you think about it, you'll start managing the risks by avoiding the risky situation. So thinking about it allows you to make it less frequent by avoiding it in the first place.
Yeah, I think that's really true. I mean, I know I think about a lot of the things to make sure that I put myself in the best situation. I mean, I think we all do, and to some extent. And thank you so much. I mean, if there's anything else we can do, keep in contact. We'd love to hear more of what you're doing.
I sure will, and thanks to everybody out here for listening in. Anything we can do to help, we will.
Great. Thank you so much.
Okay.
Bye. All right,
take-